You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. This hour, we're going to talk with the filmmaker of a new documentary that pulls back the curtain on what corporations and governments learn about us through things like our internet use, cell phone usage, and what, if anything, we can do about it. Cullen Hoback is documentary filmmaker, and he's the creator of the film Terms and Conditions May Apply. Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Program.
Thank you. It's good to be on.
So when did you start to make to work on this film?
I started about 2.5 years ago. I started pretty much just by asking a very simple, or at least I thought simple, question, which is, how is technology changing us? And it was really after a year of diving into that that I realized it wasn't necessarily the technology itself that had changed us, but what was behind that technology. All these mm-hmm. contracts that are virtually invisible that come with everything we do in our digital lives.
Well, when I was watching this, I guess I was thinking a little bit about my own usage of software, and certainly every time you sign up for a service, there's a little box that says check here to indicate that you've read the terms and conditions, and you suggest most of us don't. I had to raise my hand and say, you know, I usually read the first couple of paragraphs just because, but wow, these things are... I don't know what language they're written in, but it doesn't seem to have much relationship to English.
They're written in lawyer.
Okay, they're written in a lawyer, which is a completely different language. And are they actually meant to be read? Are they written for people to actually read them?
Of course not. No, they're designed to be as unapproachable and as unfriendly and unwieldy as possible. You know, these things are sometimes more than 40 pages long if you print them out, and they have parts that are in all caps. It's really tiny font, and then it's using legalese that's not approachable for the average person. So even if you were to try to read them, it would be hard to actually understand what the company is trying to take from you or how the company is trying to protect itself.
So they don't want us to read these things.
No, I mean, they're you make it extremely easy to bypass it, and then were you to read it, it would take you 180 hours every year just to read all of these agreements that we click on over the course of a year. That's basically a month of work. So,
but then
it's clearly not designed to be read.
Here's the flip side of that. If I say, no, I don't accept your terms and conditions, well, then the whole conversation stops. I don't get to use that piece of free software or that social networking website or even maybe that email system.
That's right. You know, it's either you get the service or you don't. So we really have no bargaining power right now. And that's part of the problem. You know, and you'll hear sometimes people will say, well, you know, why don't you just get off of the social network if you have a problem with it? And the reality is, for a lot of people, you know, for their jobs, they need to be on LinkedIn. If you're in high school in particular, not being a part of Facebook is kind of akin to social suicide. And the reality is, a lot of these things are just an intrinsic part of modern life. So that's what we deal with in the film as well. So what do we do about this?
Mm-hmm.
And what are the implications?
So, well, I guess that, yeah, we do want to get to that. What do we do about it? And I have to tell you that it was, the longer I watched, the more depressed I got. and I doubt if that was your intent, but it was like, holy cow, you know, I mean, it's you against the machine, and there are a lot of people who don't think there's a problem with this.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm trying to do with the film, I guess, is take people down the same rabbit hole of, I don't know if I would go with depression, but at least sort of like frightening, eye-opening moments that I experience in the process of uncovering what it really means when we're using these services and how our data can be used in unforeseen ways.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to hear depressed, because usually I hear people are sort of frightened and angry a little bit by the time they're done with the film. And of course, with everything that's happened with Snowden recently, that's really opened up the conversation as well. So.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because there have been other whistleblowers, as you point out, but he was the first one to really make us sit up and take notice. But what he was talking about is really stuff that's been going on for quite a while.
It's true, yeah. I mean, people call them, you know, the Snowden revelations, right? And for me, it's not really a revelation at all. This is stuff that, like you said, there have been whistleblowers coming out for years telling us that these systems were in place. And that's what I detail in the film, is kind of how we got here, and I show how the corporate side connects to the government side, and, you know, how those things overlap, and how, you know, how they're mutually beneficial. But when we look at what happened with Snowden, I think what is so profoundly different than the past whistleblowers, what the lesson perhaps he learned was, bring some documents, you know, have some hard evidence that you can show people. And the most brilliant thing, I think, actually, that Snowden did was, you know, he presented the phone records, and the phone records were something that I think people could really understand, rather than just saying, we're taking all internet traffic, recording it indefinitely. This is a very obvious smoking gun, and people could say, wow, those are my phone calls, it's the duration, it's the frequency, and that's me. That's, you know, even if you want to call it metadata, that's still me being recorded. So it suddenly felt personal for the first time.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with documentary filmmaker Colin Hoback, who has made a film titled Terms and Conditions May Apply. We're talking about what happens to all that data that we put out there, and we don't really think about it. Every time you do an internet search, whether it's Google or Bing or Dogpile or some other search engine you use, every time you visit a website, every time you send an email, every time you make a phone call, send a text message, every time you use your smartphone, you are putting out a data footprint out there. You're putting out information about yourself. That's all being collected, and it's all available. And how it's used, that's one of the questions that this film deals with. Always, as always, we welcome your participation in the program at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email address, if you dare to send one, 800-486-8655 is the phone number. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And if you can overcome your fear of loss of privacy long enough to post on Facebook, the Kathleen Dunn Program has a Facebook page, and you can leave your comment or question there. And I don't mean to make light of this. It's a pretty serious topic. But they're literally, each one of us, unless you're, you know, living in some remote mountain and have taken yourself completely off the grid, every one of us seems to have a digital footprint, and you interviewed one young man, a college student, I believe from Austria, who actually, because things are a little different in Europe than they are here, was able to get Facebook to release all the data they had on him, and it was a stack of paper that looked like it was at least a foot high.
Yeah, it's in less than 3 years, Facebook basically had aggregated a total of 1,200 pages worth of information on Max Schrems, and it's delivered in a PDF format, which is keyword searchable. So you can basically just go back in time, look at any date, and see what that individual was doing on that day, if they posted photos, who they were chatting with, who's tagged in the photos. So it really is kind of a time machine. And that was one of the most fascinating things about seeing it. Of course, in the U.S., we don't have a right to that full data set. So that he's one of only, I think, three people so far that I know of who have received the full data set that Facebook actually has on them.
So there's all this data out there about us, and it's become a real big piece of the business model for companies like Facebook. How do they make money off of what we say? Pictures we post of our cats, because that seems to be Facebook's main reason to exist, is to allow people to post pictures of their cats. So they've got all this data on us. How are they making money on that? Why is it so valuable to them?
Sure. I mean, the goal of all of these major companies, the Googles and Facebooks, Microsofts, Yahoos of the world, is that they want to know us better than we know ourselves. And they certainly want to know us better than the other company does, because ultimately they can use that information to better target us with advertising. So that's the main goal. However, we're starting to see new methodologies for the use of this data. different ways in which it can be sold. You know, it's not just about advertising necessarily anymore. It can be used for political purposes. This information can be used by an employer in the future. You know, an employer might want to know what kind of person you are, and that kind of information is very useful to them. So there's a lot of sort of different reasons to this data exists in different ways that this data can be used.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just the stuff that we put on Facebook and Twitter and the comments that we might leave at the end of a news story on the New York Times webpage or something like that. There's also a lot of data that exists about us, about our other habits. If we go to the doctor, what did we go for? And companies, for example, health insurance companies use a lot of different types of data to determine what our premiums ought to be. And you cited some examples of where premiums were increased on individuals that had nothing to do with what they did as individuals.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a possibility, right? I mean, your search history is in many ways like a stream of consciousness. It's almost like your diary. You say very personal things when you're typing into Google, and those, you know, a lot of times people will type in things into Google or a search engine that are directly associated with fears they have about health, and those things are collected. They're potentially sold. So those are all possibilities. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of, like I was saying, you know, there's a lot of different ways in which data can be used. I have an example in the film where the GPS signal from a company called TomTom, they were basically selling the speed of traffic to the cops so that the cops could give their users tickets. So that's just one example in which data can actually be used in a negative way to harm the individuals. But again, I actually think that use of data is even less concerning and alarming than the ability for these corporations, or I should say for the government, to access this information. And that happens vis-a-vis something called the third-party doctrine. And also, of course, it's granted by FISA and the Patriot Act.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about the third-party doctrine and its relationship to the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution of the United States, because that's become a very big deal. I'd like to also invite our listeners to join the discussion. Listeners, have you actually looked at the terms and conditions, say, of your iTunes account? When you go in to use iTunes, Apple's got a whole list of terms and conditions that you are supposed to read before you can use the service. Have you actually read it? And if you did, was there anything in there that concerned you? Have you opened up the terms and conditions of your latest credit card agreement? You'll probably still get a hard copy of that in the mail, but most of that stuff's online now. Have you actually taken a look to see what's in there about what they can do with your data? Or did you just assume that you were protected, that if you didn't give your permission for something, that it wasn't going to happen? We're discussing that and other things related to that idea this afternoon on the Kathleen Dunn Program with Cullen Hoback, a documentary filmmaker. He's the maker of Terms and Conditions May Apply. One of the questions we want to answer this hour is privacy dead? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, maybe it's just on life support. We'll talk about that and continue our discussion. 800-486-8655. We're going to go to a break in just a moment, and then when we come back, we'll keep talking about terms and conditions may apply. 800-486-8655, talk at WPR.org, or find the Kathleen Dunn Program on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
In fact, if you were to read everything you agreed to, it would take one full month of work out of every year. That's 180 hours you would need to spend every year. And according to the Wall Street Journal, consumers lose $250 billion each year due to what's hidden in fine print. Here's an example from LinkedIn's terms. You grant LinkedIn a non-exclusive, irrevocable, worldwide, perpetual, unlimited, assignable, sublicensable, fully paid-up, and royalty-free right to us to copy, prepare, derivative works of, improve, distribute, publish, remove, retain, edit, process, analyze, use, and commercialize in any way known or in the future discovered any information you provide directly or indirectly.
This hour, we're talking about the documentary Terms and Conditions May Apply, and we have the creator of that documentary, Cullen Hoback, with us, and with you as well at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The What was maybe the biggest surprise that you had as you were making this documentary? What thing really just jumped out at you like, I can't believe I just discovered this?
I mean, there were a few things, right? Because the film really does play out as a series of the things that surprised me along the way. I mean, one of the things, if we just want to talk about the terms and conditions, one of the things that still surprises me is that companies have a clause in there that allows them to change the terms at any time. And you'll find this in almost every agreement. And that, to me, is still just baffling, because in life, I mean, what contract would you normally sign where it's an open-ended agreement where the other party, after you've signed it, can change the terms?
I mean, yeah, without telling you or negotiating.
Right, yeah, where you have absolutely no say, and then they don't even necessarily have to inform you. I mean, you wouldn't, right? So it's still just mind-blowing to me that we have no regulation limiting these things.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because you do go into the action or lack thereof in Congress, and just prior to the things that happened on 9/11, Congress actually just in the months before that had been considering some rather sweeping privacy legislation. Talk about that a little bit, and why we haven't seen anything come out of Congress in terms of protecting people's privacy. There's been a lot of discussion, but no action.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, before 9/11, in that year, there were over 10 bills being floated on the floor of Congress to deal with privacy online. Then, of course, 9/11 happened and everything changed, and all of those bills were abandoned. And now, I think for the first time, we're seeing some potential progress. And we're seeing a major public opinion shift in relationship to these issues. I mean, right now, again, there's actually about 10 bills being floated around in some form or another that would deal with eliminating or modifying significantly FISA and the Patriot Act. So these things are being floated, but will they gain traction? That's the real challenge here. I mean, far-reaching are the defense contracting lobbies and the tech lobbies. You know, how much influence do they have in Washington? I think for a long time, tech money was considered to be a very safe form of money to take, and now we're seeing the fallout of that.
Well, you cite an example, I believe, from the California legislature about the kind of lobbying that takes place, and you have an interview with a California state senator about a privacy bill that she was promoting, and how it never even got I don't think it ever even got out of committee. Nobody from any tech company testified at any of the hearings, but their lobbyists were in the room en masse and making their presence known.
Yeah, I mean, that really speaks to the central issue, is that there is this sort of massive lobby on behalf of these tech companies wanting to keep business as usual, and it's not a very visible presence. And that's really what I'm hitting at in the film, is, you know, regardless of whether or not it was a good bill, they should have at least come forth and said why it wasn't a good bill in public, right? I mean, that's the whole point of having that kind of forum, is for open debate, so we can at least understand, well, you know, if this is actually, if you feel like this is actually bad for the user, if you feel like this is bad for people in large, at least come forward and say that. When the tech lobby just sits back and doesn't actually say anything in a public forum, it makes their motives more dubious.
Mm-hmm. And you have footage in the documentary about congressional hearings and responses that people have made to questions and so forth. The lobbyists for the tech firms say there's no problem here. There's, you know, nothing's wrong.
Right,
just
yeah.
Let us keep doing what we're doing, and nobody has any reason to worry about us.
Yeah, I mean, there's this idea that by putting some form of regulation on these companies, by requiring us to have access to our data, that in some way it would be a massive economic detriment. And this is especially true in California, but it's true on the national level as well. And, you know, the notion that privacy is somehow the enemy of innovation, I just think is a fallacy. And that point is hit home in the film. It's just that privacy is the enemy of the current business model. It's not necessarily the enemy of innovation.
Yeah, and of course, you know, anytime you have this discussion, the old saw is trotted out. Well, if you aren't doing anything wrong, if you don't have anything to hide, you don't have anything to worry about.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that idea is something that I really try to focus on in the movie, because I show just a series of perfectly innocent people having their lives upended as a byproduct of these spy systems. You know, these spy systems are not very good at context. And if you post a joke on Facebook and SWAT shows up at your house and you were just trying to share a joke with your friends, I mean, what happened to freedom of speech? You haven't committed a crime yet. They're there to prevent a crime from happening, you know? And that's really dicey territory. And that's what these, you know, you'll see it in the contracts. I mean, the contracts say that they can share information with the government to prevent crimes from happening, and that's the nature, and that's what we see play out time and time again in the film, where the U.S. government in some way, shape, or form is stopping someone because of a tweet, stopping someone because of something they've put on Facebook, stopping someone because of search history. You know, these things, we have moved from a society where there needs to be probable cause to a society now where you have to prove your innocence, and that to me is very alarming.
And we have audio from the documentary of a seventh grader who ended up getting a visit from the FBI because of a Facebook post. I think let's listen to that clip about Vito, the seventh grader, please, if we could.
A man walked in a suit and glasses, and he said that he was part of the Secret Service, and he told me it was because of a post that I made, and it indicated as a threat towards the president.
Yes, a seventh grade boy was visited by our FBI because of a red flag that came up in their spy system.
I was saying how Osama is dead and for Obama to be careful because there might be suicide bombers.
It didn't consider his age, or that his comment about Obama needing to watch out was one of concern. The machine simply determined that based on a series of words, Vito was a potential threat.
This is an example of what you were talking about context not being applied to any of this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that's the real problem here, is you get these false positives, and say the system's accurate, you know, 99.99% of the time. Well, that's not very good. It means that maybe, you know, one out of, you know, if you're scraping millions and millions and millions of people, you're going to end up visiting a lot of perfectly innocent people. In this case, a seventh grade boy, you know, who's basically saying, "Hey, Obama, you know, you just killed Osama. Watch out. You know, there might be an attack." And that is suddenly, you know, and without warning his parents, the FBI is suddenly questioning him. I mean, that to me is really concerning.
And you do show some examples in the book of people who've been visited by SWAT teams because of a tweet or a Facebook post. A man visiting America from Ireland ended up spending the night in jail, I think it was, because of something he posted on Facebook before he came over.
Yeah, he had a tweet where he said, I'm gonna go destroy America, and he ends it with a kiss. Which means to party in America. You know, he's a joker. He had lots of jokes. If you'd read any of his other tweets, you would know this is not a man who's openly broadcasting that he's actually going to destroy America. He makes a great point. He's like, well, if I had tweeted that I'm going to go and paint the town red, they'd have me down for graffiti.
Yeah, he'd be in jail for vandalism.
Right.
Okay. We've got a lot of people suddenly who want to join us by phone. Let's take some calls. We'll start in Sun Prairie, where Heather is with us. Heather, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Hey, this is really interesting to me. In fact, your last story is a little bit like what I have to share. This is before, you know, the fact that the government was collecting all our phone data, particularly if people for non-American citizens. And I happen to be married to a non-American citizen who has lived, for his primary address, I'm here right now in the United States for a decade, but he travels for work. My husband's Portuguese, and the last time he was coming through, and I believe it was Newark, he had been working in Brazil. He got pulled aside. They pulled his green card, and they went back to like this whole database of where he'd been and whatever. And he was questioned as to, you know, why hadn't he decided to get his American citizenship? And the answer to that, sorry, everybody, is he has no interest in becoming an American citizen. Thank you very much. He's not a giant fan all the time. And then they told him that they could destroy his green card at that moment. And then, you know, he would just be trapped there and not be able to get back in to the country, and, you know, he'd have to figure it out. And it didn't matter that, you know, he has an American wife and two dual national children living outside of Madison, Wisconsin. And that was that. I mean, they didn't, but he was heavily warned that, you know, he had better watch the way he talked to people because they had the right to remove, to, you know, basically destroy his green card. End of story.
Heather, thanks for sharing that with us. Cullen Hoback?
Yeah, I mean, was there, so in this story, obviously it's a frustrating experience. Did he experience anything in relationship to digital surveillance, or was there anything where they said, well, why were you doing X, Y, or Z that they brought up that you know of?
Heather, are you still with us?
Heather, are you there?
He works for a company out of Portugal, but he does consulting in Portuguese-speaking countries. So very often he doesn't fly, like, the United States to Brazil, the United States to Mozambique. He flies the United States, Portugal, Portugal, Brazil, Brazil back to Portugal, Portugal back to the United States. And they had been, you know, monitoring all of that kind of stuff. And we're very concerned, apparently, about what he was doing. And I mean, he speaks Portuguese and he has an MBA. It's not like a super secret, you know, spy ring, but apparently, you know, according to whatever, you know, tracks he's leaving behind, they weren't convinced that, you know, they could have been protecting everybody from our very nefarious family.
Right. I mean, I think that this speaks to a broader issue, which is the degree to which we've turned up the volume on how much surveillance we're doing and, like, the level of security. I was speaking with someone the other day who said that her father, American citizen, pulled aside and questioned over a search that he had made on Google. They asked him, well, why were you searching for scentless poison? And he says, well, I was writing a book. And this is just, it's alarming that we are questioning people who, you know, who shouldn't be questioned because they haven't actually done anything yet. All, you know, searching for something, traveling somewhere, this is not necessarily probable cause. Now, I don't know what the exact field your husband was working in, but, you know, I think that these situations should you know, cause us to ask more questions about how much privacy we're willing to exchange in relation to security. And when we look at what General Alexander came out and said recently in response to just the phone records situation, there hasn't been a single good example of the value of this data scraping system. It was, I think the only example he could really come up with was that it saved, you know, they caught someone who had given $8,000 to Al-Qaeda. That was it.
Mm-hmm. Heather, thanks so much for the call. 800-486-8655 is the number to use to join the program today. 800-486-8655. Talking with Cullen Hoback, a documentary filmmaker of the film Terms and Conditions May Apply. And you talk about how there's, you know, the data that's out there about us is more than just about what we do on our phones or about what we do on social media or email or search engines or whatever. There's electronic surveillance going on all the time. You talk about the use, increasing use of camera surveillance in large cities all over the world. And as we just heard about the situation regarding Heather's husband, the way we travel, our travel habits and things are being monitored. All this data exists out there, and it's all being used, but often without any sort of context, as we've seen. And you have another example in the documentary of someone who had some, well, they were rather interesting Google searches, and it turns out he was writing for a primetime television drama and needed to know about how a person might go about killing his wife.
Uh-huh, yeah, he was a writer on Cold Case at the time. And basically what happened was AOL released a bunch of anonymized search records, and there were all of these people online who were looking at this list of search records and going, wow, this, you know, it said like wife killer, how to kill my wife, decapitated bodies, all of this stuff, and everyone just assumed that it must be someone plotting a murder. Well, so I go in and show this list to this individual and say, you know, have you looked for anything on this list? And he says, well, yeah, I've looked for everything on this list. And I'm like, well, you'll be happy to know that the internet thinks that you're a murderer. And he goes, well, no, I'm a writer. You know, I'm researching for Cold Case. So again, yeah, it speaks to the problem of context and that these systems aren't very good at it. But I would also say that that's not even really looking at the right, it's not really asking the right question. You know, we shouldn't be asking, do these systems work? We should be asking, are these systems unconstitutional? And if they're unconstitutional, then I think that's the bottom line. And we need to dial it back and say, okay, well, let's reassess the kinds of surveillance that we're willing to experience, especially on a domestic level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in this case, the case that we were just discussing, this was supposedly data is only supposed to be kept for I think it was 6 months, 18 months, something like that, and then it's supposed to be destroyed or deleted or completely anonymized. But the truth is, it's not really. There's no such thing as anonymous online anymore.
Not really. I think that. Well, you brought up the point earlier of this idea of, you know, the cameras in cities and things like that, but I want to talk a little bit about what I think is the scarier concept, which is this idea of retrospective surveillance, which is that by virtue of being able to store information, as you were just describing, and they keep expanding and extending the length and time for which, you know, this data can be stored, but just imagine you have this giant dossier being built on you. Now you incorporate cameras into that, and you incorporate facial recognition into all of those cameras. So suddenly there's this virtual panopticon where everywhere you're going, you're being recorded, monitored, and you know it's you, and you can go back in time and look at that because it's being stored. You can see who you were relating to, what you were saying, what you were doing, and perhaps in the future what you were thinking. And the potential for misuse with a system like that is really alarming. That's what Edward Snowden came out and said. He said, "Look, this is, you can turn anyone into a criminal if you want to. I mean, if you go back, you can find anything that makes someone look bad or anything that someone's done that is illegal in some way, shape, or form."
Let's take another call. Bill in New Berlin is with us. Bill, good afternoon.
Hello.
Yeah, Bill, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I have two comments. Just before the break, you asked if anybody reads terms and conditions. Well, I've learned to have to do that because I've been stung by crooks 4 or 5 times. For example, one guy offered a tooth brightening paste sample for $1.95, so I bid on it. And all of a sudden, I started getting bills for money taken out of my checking account for $86 a month. Turns out, after I researched him, that he had stolen Microsoft, one of their software things, and was selling it on the internet. And Microsoft sued him, and on the day that they would go to court for Microsoft's $1 million suit, the guy walked into court, handed the Microsoft lawyer $1 million and walked back out. Anyway, I had to go all the way up to the vice president of my banking corporation to get my money refunded. Turns out he says that in the terms and conditions, it says he could do that. But and as they were supposedly posted online, but they were not posted online. Oh, well, live and learn.
Yeah, so I mean, this is, I mean, the fact is that $250 billion each year is the cost to consumers from not reading the fine print. That's an astounding number.
Right. So now I read the terms and conditions every time before I sign up for something.
Bill, good luck, and good for you.
I have one more comment.
Sure, go ahead.
A story came out this week that now the NSA is requiring people's passwords. Well, that scared the crap out of me because I do all my banking, income and outflow, online. So they gave some tips as to how to protect your password from being scammed by the government, and I changed mine to meet those needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was Bill. Thanks for bringing that up because that is an issue that's been raised. No one, as to my knowledge, no company has actually given up any passwords. But there have been there has been a persistent story out there that the NSA would like to collect them. And we need to take a break. But when we come back, I'd like to get your thoughts on that. In my case, good luck. The NSA should have good luck remembering my passwords because I can never do it. So have at it. And Bill, thanks for the call. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have more about the documentary Terms and Conditions May Apply, including your phone calls if you choose to join us at 800-486-8655. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Say, stay tuned. Coming up at 3 o'clock on Central Time, some companies are starting to give their employees unlimited vacation time. Rob and Veronica talk about the pros and cons. Also, is there an incentive for politicians to exaggerate the risk of a terrorist attack? That's coming up after 3 o'clock on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about the documentary Terms and Conditions May Apply, with Cullen Hoback, the creator of that documentary, and with you at 800-486-8655. So we have the news story just surfacing, as Bill pointed out in his call, that they would like to have your passwords. Well, you know, that seems like that's a real eyebrow raiser. You want my what? Why would we give them our passwords, and what conceivable need could they have to do that?
Well, I mean, I don't have a perfect answer. I think the reality is that the NSA, and anyone working in an agency which is designed to protect us, is going to go as far as we allow them to. I mean, their job is to try to protect us, right? Like, that's their real objective here. But the problem is that we haven't put any limitations on them. We used to have all kinds of limitations, on the FBI back in the day, and on unreasonable search and seizure, like what it took to get into someone's home, what it took to get a wiretap on someone's phone. But given this whole new digital medium, for some reason, none of those protections have followed. And until we start putting some kind of limitation, the NSA is going to go as far as it can to get as much as it can.
Well, let's talk about the third-party exclusion, because you deal with that in the documentary, and this idea that the government can get around the Fourth Amendment by saying, well, look, you gave this information to a third party, we're going to get it from them, and we don't need a court order to do that.
Yeah, it's a super clever loophole. Back in 2002, they tried to enact a program called Total Information Awareness. The objective of Total Information Awareness was to get all of our phone records or flight information or bank records, all this stuff, and mash it up into one profile. And it was incredibly unpopular once it became public knowledge that this program was being brought into effect, and it was killed, and people were outraged. It cut to a couple of years later. Does that sound familiar? Facebook comes out, and it does perfectly what Total Information was designed to do. Except now what's brilliant is that the government could use this thing we're talking about now called the third-party doctrine to access that information. Which, the way the third-party doctrine works is that if you give your information to a Google, a Facebook, AT&T, any company, you basically have given up your rights over that information. You've handed it to that company, and then the government can go to that company and get it directly from them. It's much, much easier for the government to go to a third party and get it than it is for them to come through us directly, which is why Total Information Awareness was such a failure, also because it was a really creepy name.
Well, and they had a really creepy logo.
Super creepy.
Like, yeah.
A pyramid with an eye on it scanning the Earth with a laser beam.
Yeah, I mean, it was the Illuminati all over again. I mean, it was just, it looked like a conspiracy theory waiting to happen.
yeah, I mean, and, you know, the new one's a little better. It looks more like a Pearl Jam cover or something.
By the way, before I forget, where can we see this documentary? Is it available for the general public to watch?
Yeah, so right now we're in, I think, 15 to 20 theatrical markets. But you can actually demand a screening at any cinema, basically, pretty much any cinema in your area. All you have to do, if you go to our website, which is TACMA.net, that's Terms and Conditions May Apply.net, you can go there, you just click, you can set up a screening. If you get 50 or 60 people to, you know, who say, like in Madison, for instance, that they all want to attend it, then the screening is a go, and you can watch it that way. It'll also be airing on Pivot TV, which is a new network launching on August 1st, and it'll be on Pivot on August 11th, and then it's going to be available digitally across all platforms starting in September.
So. Okay. All right. Good information to know. Here's an email from CM. Who says he wants to let people know his internet provider is the biggest and most recognizable cable internet provider. They have interrupted my service, he says, and claimed they had reports of malicious activity from my address. This occurred right after I sent a critical but non-threatening email to a governor. People need to know that their internet providers might turn over anything when asked and will interfere with our privacy at will. You do show some examples of how easy it is for the government to get information from our internet activity in your film.
Oh yeah, I mean, look, ISPs, internet service providers, most of them just have a rate sheet, and the rate sheet is just like, okay, well, if you want to subpoena this information, this is how much it costs to get it. So that's pretty much how that relationship works. I mean, it's different with every government agency, how they're able to access the information. Of course, there's a lot of questions as to exactly what the NSA is able to access in regards to our online activity. I think if you look at the actual documents that Snowden brought forth, it seems pretty clear to me that they have something akin to a form of direct access. And if it's not direct, it's so easy that it may as well be.
There are companies that make a lot of money selling software and hardware to supposedly to the government, but perhaps anybody could buy this that would allow people's Facebook accounts to be hacked and even our cell phone communications and not just our communications, but anything we're doing with a smartphone can be monitored. But you cite some examples of technology that's actually being sold and marketed by companies. Hey, here's how you can keep track of all this for anybody.
Oh yeah, it's a huge industry. It's growing rapidly. You know, these are basically systems that are designed for monitoring. So say you're not the NSA, say you're a local law enforcement or your FBI or CIA or any agency in the world. You go to these conventions and hundreds of companies are there selling software and hardware devices which are designed to extract, say, information from someone's cell phone, to hack into and monitor hundreds of thousands of Facebook accounts at the same time, or hundreds and thousands of cell phones at the same time. And there's no regulation on who these can be sold to. I show a case in the film where one of these systems was sold to the government in Egypt to monitor protesters, and they even sold a training program. I think it was Finn Fisher that sold it to them. So, I mean, this is another sort of back-end problem that's going on here. It goes beyond the NSA. I mean, the fact that there's just an entire industry out there which is based on selling surveillance products is a problem in and of itself.
And you also talk about how there's something in every one of our smartphones, a piece of basically its software that's required to be there that has some real privacy concerns.
It was discovered a couple of years ago by, I think, a programmer on the East Coast, and it's called Carrier IQ, and Carrier IQ essentially monitors every keystroke and sends it back to that company, and they ended up calling. I mean, if you can monitor every keystroke on a cell phone, you essentially know what that person's looking for, who they're calling. There's a lot of things that, I mean, the company itself called the data that they were getting a treasure trove. So that's just one example of the kinds of surveillance that's going on all around us all the time, and that's one that we found out. I'm sure there are plenty that we don't know about.
Well, and it was pretty interesting. One of the pieces of film you have there is a dialogue between a member of Congress and the director of the FBI. He was asked point blank, "Do you use this?" And he said, "Well, no, we don't use it, but the carriers may use it, and we get our information from them." Which is kind of that's sort of an equivocation.
A nice little two-step, right?
Right. So this is out there, and I guess it begs the question: is privacy dead? What do you think?
Well, privacy lives on a spectrum, and right now we have almost eradicated it. Right? It's on its dying breath. I think that we're having a conversation now, though, about how do we get some of that back, especially as technology keeps evolving and these systems improve. It's going to become even more of a problem. It's very convenient for the companies in Silicon Valley to promote the idea that privacy is dead and say, you know, we're moving into a new place where privacy doesn't matter. And, of course, it's convenient for them to say that when it aligns with their business models. In reality, you can't say that privacy doesn't matter if some people have it and some people don't. If the government has privacy and needs secrets, but its citizens don't, that's how you can easily install a totalitarian state. If you want transparency, it has to be transparency for all, and that is not what we have right now.
Well, I found it interesting that you had the chairman of Google, I think it was, on, and he talking about, well, you know, the idea is if you don't want someone to read something or see it or know about it, don't put it out there. He wasn't too happy when someone put up a picture taken apparently from Google Earth of his house. And then you had the encounter with an up close and personal encounter with Mark Zuckerberg, and that was kind of interesting how he responded to you.
Yeah, I mean the reason I did that is because I tried getting through to Facebook, you know, many times, and they wouldn't return my emails. I went into their office; they told me just to send them an email. I'm like, is there someone here that I can talk to about the privacy concerns on Facebook? And they said, send us an email, and then I never heard back from them. So it speaks to the greater problem, which is that Facebook wants us to be transparent. They can promote this idea of, you know, a more open world, but the second that you want some transparency from them, you know, there it's an iron curtain. So that's what motivated me to go to Mark Zuckerberg's house. You know, it was really just trying to point out the hypocrisy of Silicon Valley, especially the higher-ups there. You know, this idea that they want privacy, but we don't get to have it.
I must say, I expected him to live in a nicer neighborhood.
He's moved since then.
Oh, okay.
The house is also much larger than you'd expect, and it was only a block away from the Facebook campus.
So, oh, okay. All right.
He probably dug out a tunnel after I went to
house. So, what do you have any suggestions for those of us who'd like to maybe try to recapture some of our privacy? I know you had one interview that your subject said, "Well, if it's digital, it's not private." But is there did you come away with anything? Any suggestions for us on what we might do to try to regain or maybe hang on to what's left of our privacy?
Yeah, it's been really interesting and also hopeful since I've completed the film. I've met a lot of great organizations and sort of come up with some new ideas on what we can do. So first off, I think there's just a reality that we need to get, you know, a threshold we need to cross, which is just building more awareness in America about what the capacity of these systems are and what the actual cost is. And once we do that, then we can start to affect some change. So hopefully in some ways the film will help with that. Just by understanding what we're losing can help us understand the value of privacy in this space. And in the meantime, there are some tools out there you can use. Disconnect and Ghostery are both ways to stop third-party tracking or very much limit it. Firefox, you can enable some private browsing and also turn off cookies. And you can do anonymous searching with an engine called DuckDuckGo. But these don't solve the bigger problem. The bigger problem is really data control. Right now, companies own our data. We don't. And this may seem like a radical idea, but I don't think it's actually that radical. The idea that we should be owners of our digital selves, that personal information online should be our property. We should be able to take it from one service to another if we want. We should be able to delete it. We should be lending it to Facebook. That's how I think it should be looked at. And if Facebook betrays our trust, we should be able to take it away and have control over our digital footprint. So what we've started is a website called trackoff.us. That's Track Off Us. And at that website, it's going to be our social or our like activism hub. And our first step is to get congressmen to see the film. Because I don't really think that a lot of people on Capitol Hill fully understand how these systems work. So that's a great start. But from there, we're going to move on to the thing that I was just talking about, this idea of data control and pushing companies to push the government into, into giving us some Fourth Amendment protections online, giving us control over our digital selves.
And speaking of pushing, I'm going to have to push you off because we're at the end of the hour, so we're out of time. But there's a link to your website on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook page. Thanks so much, Colin Hoback, creator of the documentary Terms and Conditions May Apply. KP Whaley produced this program. Rhonda Fanning handled on-air production. I'm John Munson. It's the Ideas Network.